You might remember this past January on the last Sunday of the month, we had a congregational meeting, wasn't too long ago. Remember that? Okay, and typically on those Sundays for the sermon itself, we try to address a number of issues dealing with our local congregation. And this year, I really didn't see anything that warranted that much attention, and so I gave a message on congregational prayers, somewhat related. But in the weeks that followed that congregational meeting, a few questions and comments about our church have come up, and either from the affirmation forms that we read through or emails we received or one-on-one interactions, that sort of thing. And as we were discussing some of those in our last couple meetings, we thought it might be beneficial to address them openly with the whole church. And so today we'll have that congregational briefing before the congregational meeting that we didn't have in January. And three of us will be participating in that today, myself and then Tim and then Dave. So one question, and it seemed to be a pretty big deal to me, concerned the vision of our church. Apparently it isn't all that clear to a couple of our folks, and in some ways I was a little bit surprised by this. And given that we have a number of new folks, it seems that this might actually be a good time to talk about it, and perhaps some of our members would benefit from a bit of a refresher on the subject. And so I'll be getting into that this morning along with a couple other related topics. There's also been some questions about our finances. We seem to have the opposite problem that many churches, unfortunately, and nonprofits have. We are in the black, not in the red. Our church is blessed with a number of faithful givers. We haven't mismanaged those funds. As you heard again this morning, we bring that before the Lord in our congregational meetings for wisdom. We try to be careful, frugal, but without being stingy. And over the course of several years, all of this has resulted in a surplus. It's not a large surplus, but it is a surplus. And so some have wondered what the plan is for all that extra money. And different people have different ideas about that and sometimes strongly held ideas. And I addressed this just real briefly at the congregational meeting, but it could stand to have some more explanation. So Tim will follow me and talk about that. And he's also going to deal with other questions that have come up recently, like what exactly do the elders do and what goes on in their meetings and questions about what the elders are doing to better equip themselves through personal and or group study and related stuff like that. And then following this, Dave will come and offer some final words on a variety of related subjects, concluding with a challenge to the church body, or at least that's what he's supposed to be doing. I'm not real sure. Is that what you're going to be doing? Never mind. Listening faithfully as always. All right. So before I get into my main subject here, there's a couple other matters I'd like to kind of deal with, and it seems to be kind of a good time for it. I know that many of our members appreciate Dave and Tim and the sacrifices they make to serve our church, but I'm not sure if they really get the kind of support that they actually deserve, and I think that we kind of tend to take them for granted. Josh Birch and Josh Miles, though they are not elders at the moment, they are part of this team as well, and our church really is richer, better because of the service that these guys provide, and they faithfully serve with diligence. And just as one example, sermons, for instance, here, they take a lot of time to prepare. It's not the sort of thing that you can throw together in just 15 or 20 hours. There's a lot of work that goes into it. And there are, of course, meetings to attend and other things that come up that require a lot of time and effort. And so I would just encourage you, it might be nice from time to time to offer them some encouragement and appreciation. And a second thing I'd like to mention deals with a certain, lack of a better word, complaint that I've heard just a lot of times over the course of the years here. And it has to do with this business of feeling like you don't fit in. I don't feel connected. I feel like an outsider. I long for a sense of belonging, but I just don't have it here. And no one reaches out to me and, you know, those sorts of statements. And not always, but typically this is the sort of thing I hear when someone is thinking about trying out other churches. And if you happen to be one who feels this way, well, I might just offer some suggestions. These are obvious suggestions, but now's a good time to bring them up. You might start with consistent attendance on Sunday mornings. You might also try coming to church events like our picnics, graduation parties when they're held, special events like Good Friday, Christmas Eve, and show up on one of those Saturdays when we help a fellow member move, you know, these kinds of things. And get involved in one of the home groups and maybe more than one, and you might try inviting people to your home. There's all sorts of things here. I just encourage you to be a little less self-focused and a little bit more outward-focused, a little bit more servant-oriented. Visit Darlene. Visit Tina. Send words of encouragement to those in our church going through a hard time. You know, be more of a giver. On Sunday, go around and actually talk to other people, like even leave your seat to do that. And look for the person that you know the least and go up to them and strike up a conversation. So basically, take initiative. Now, all these are obvious, but it's been my observation that when someone is feeling disconnected, it's because they aren't really putting a lot of effort into it themselves. And building relationships and attaining a sense of unity and a sense of belonging just takes work. It just does. All right, so what is our church's vision? Can the church spell it out in one clear sentence? So when Paul left Titus in Crete to shore up the new churches there, he gave him a whole list of things that Titus needed to do. And the same when he left Timothy in Titus, or when he left Timothy in Ephesus. Wow. Same thing when he left Timothy in Ephesus. Everyone's following me so far. In both situations, nothing was ever said about crafting up a vision statement. And through the centuries, that sort of thing has never even occurred to churches, that this is something they needed to think about and write out. And, of course, all of this is a recent thing. It's kind of a byproduct of the modern church. Every church seems to think that they need something to set them apart from all the others, something that can be captured in a short and catchy phrase, a phrase that can be posted prominently on their website and bulletins and the marquee out front and all that stuff. And I found several online in just in a couple of minutes. To know Christ and to make him known, to be a people who act like Jesus, to make faith intersect with real life, to awake our city and transform it, to connect people to Jesus and to each other, to help people find their God-given purpose and to fulfill it, loving God, loving people, serving the world, to know Christ, show Christ, and be Christ to all we meet, and things along that line. And there's nothing wrong with these. They're all worthwhile visions. But personally, I think vision statements are more about marketing than actually serving as the central principle that everything in the church revolves around. And more times than not, the vision statement doesn't really drive the church's goals and objectives when you look at it. If you really want to know what the actual vision of a church is, then you look at their programs, their ministries, the ministries they support, the kinds of things they keep repeating and emphasizing, you know, what seems to be their priorities. What do their Sunday school and youth programs look like? What are they teaching the kids? What are they teaching the adults? Check out their sermons, even their songs, and so on. Reading their philosophy of ministry, philosophy of worship, statement of faith, again, would all be quite telling. So I'd be reluctant to say that a church's vision, the thing that throttles the church forward, can be captured in a brief phrase, or for that matter, articulated even in a paragraph or even in a 3,000-word document. So when I'm asked about this for our church, I generally mention Ephesians 4 and the three pastoral epistles. Many other passages could be referred to, but these are the ones that serve as kind of like a starting point. Ephesians 4 presents the philosophy of it. This is the idea, the principle, and 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus are instructions on how to do it. And it seems that Paul's already figured this stuff out, and it would serve us well to defer to him rather than trying to come up with something novel and clever on our own. So a year ago, I spent two Sundays on Ephesians 4, and for this morning, I'll make just a few quick comments about it. The subject itself that is being addressed begins with verse 1, but for the sake of time, we'll just skip ahead to verse 11. This is a very familiar passage. Even though I gave two Sundays on it last year, we've talked about it through the decades quite a bit. So Paul writes, "It was he who gave some to be apostles, some to be prophets, some to be evangelists, some to be pastors and teachers, to prepare God's people for works of service, so that the body of Christ may be built up, until we all reach unity in the faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God and become mature, attaining to the whole measure of the fullness of Christ. Then we will no longer be infants tossed back and forth by the waves, blown here and there by every wind of teaching and by the cunning and craftiness of men in their deceitful scheming. Instead, speaking the truth in love, we will in all things grow up into him who is the head, that is Christ. From him the whole body, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love as each part does its work. As each part does its work. So again, familiar passage. These verses deal with God's fascinating design of how each of us, in the context of a church family, contributes to the discipleship and edification of all the other members. The verses before this that we didn't read talk about how God has given to each one of us a measure of grace, divinely enabled each of us, so as to serve others in the church and to serve the church as a whole. This so that we can build others up in love, grow and mature, and thus attain to the whole measure of the fullness of Christ. That is, be transformed into his image. And this is something that we strive for. It's part of our philosophy of church, if you will. And the words every member ministry that you've heard a number of times seem to capture the general idea here. The passage also highlights this often overlooked but yet significant principle that God designed the members of a local church body to grow together as a unit, in contrast to the idea that each of the individual parts grow separately, independently of the others, which is typically how we've been conditioned to think about it. And the analogy is simple enough. A finger, for instance, doesn't grow independently of the hand or of the wrist or of the arm. And through childhood, the ears mature and develop with the rest of the body, and so on and so on. And along that line, all the various parts, in some way, when you take time to kind of think through this, contribute to the health and growth of that body. And so it is with the church family. Our being conformed into the image of God's Son is something that we all share in together, contribute to together, and experience together. And Calvin put it well. He said, if we want to be considered members of Christ, let no man be anything for himself, but let us all be whatever we are for the benefit of each other. So to sum it up from this passage in Ephesians 4, the goal is attaining to the whole measure of the fullness of Christ, being transformed into his image. Reaching that goal requires unity in the faith, maturity, being built up, growing in Christ, and we get there by the proper working of each individual part, all the members serving in their divinely enabled ministries. And one of the ways God has enabled the church to do this is through the service provided by the elders and teachers who are given the charge of equipping God's people for works of service in verse 12. So now as we move on and look at the three pastoral epistles, we see this fleshed out in the practical realm. Paul gives Timothy and Titus specific instructions on how to govern the church, what to teach the members, how to deal with certain challenges that will come up, and so on. And these three short letters are something like the owner's manual for a local church. You know, to make things work like it was designed, do this and don't do this. So essentially, all of this is basically putting into practice the charge from the Great Commission, where Jesus says, teach my followers to obey all my commands. And notice that what he says, not just teach them the commands, but also teach them to obey my commands. And that would be really a great vision statement for a church. So teach them to obey the word of the Lord involves all those things that are important to us here, discipleship, equipping, honoring the authority of Scripture, spurring one another's on toward love and good deeds, admonishing, challenging, holding others accountable, and so on and so on. So we have two booklets. You are probably familiar with these. We have one called An Introduction to the Church, and there we address our philosophy of ministry, philosophy of worship, philosophy of membership, statement of faith, and so on. And this might be a place to start, and even members might want to pick it up and read through it about once a year. And the other is the membership handbook. Aren't these classy looking? Like, it doesn't get any more attractive than this, does it? Slick. We're all about image here. So, and I would encourage members to read through the membership handbook once a year as well. It gets in all the details about how we govern ourselves and all of our various practices and policies. So between those two booklets, you should come away with a good grasp of what is important to us, which is all part of the vision. One of the key components necessary to fulfill our vision, philosophy, and purpose as derived from Ephesians 4 is church membership. So let me just talk about that here briefly for a moment in kind of closing here. Everyone is called upon to serve, and those who serve need to be on the same page, or as Paul put it in that passage, unity in the faith. And so membership is simply a way to ensure that. Here is our beliefs, our philosophy of ministry, our policies. Here is how we govern ourselves, our priorities. In membership, a person gives his or her formal agreement. You know, I'm with you on all that. Count me in. And without that, we'd have no way of keeping things in check. It would just be a free-for-all. And this is our eldership. These are the men you agree to. These are the men that you agree to recognize as your church leaders. They, according to the scriptures, will give an account to God for those under their care. And they need to know who those people are that they're accountable for. And membership formalizes that. You give them permission to relate to you in that role, and you agree to relate to them accordingly. And if you aren't a member of a church, then you don't really have any church eldership over you, and you are, in essence, claiming that 1 Thessalonians 5, 12, and 13, and Hebrews 13 and 17 don't apply to you. And that's never a good thing to claim that some verses apply to other Christians, but not to yourself. So I think those sorts of things are useful in discussions that come up with others, other Christians that don't believe in membership, and I think those are good points to raise with them about that. Now, given the nature of how we understand and practice membership here, it's our policy to give newer folks some time to see whether this is the kind of church that they, whether this is the church that they want to commit to. But that sort of thing doesn't require several years. After about 10 or 12 months, I would think someone would know whether we are a good fit or not. And if not, then, you know, to say as politely as I can, they need to look for a church that is a good fit. The one thing that we don't want to do is accommodate this spirit of individualism, this I don't need to be committed to a church, I don't need an eldership over me. And that's a mentality that really is prevalent among Christians today. And we are just obligated to push back on that kind of thinking. So if you are a member, then fulfill the obligations you agreed to. And you might read through those occasionally, at least once a year. You know, basically get your oar in the water. If you are new, then take some time to learn all you can about us and what is expected of members. Think of this as a time of courtship. It's not recreational dating, but courtship with a purpose. And if you have been with us for over a year and still not a member, the question is, what's holding you back? Finally, there have been other questions raised I'd like to get into, but we just don't have time for. Maybe we can address them at some point. These various comments include, many sermons seem to lack practical application. The church can sometimes come across as arrogant. The affirmation form should be anonymous. Members should have more input into how the church is governed, kind of like a cry for democracy. And we need home groups. Well, home groups are back. And we'll now have to kind of see whether, how folks show up and participate in those. All right. So with that, I'm going to turn over to Tim, and then Dave will follow him.
So as Wendell said, I have about three topics I'm going to address this morning that have either come up in the affirmation forums or in private conversations. But the first relates to elder professional development. Essentially, what do the elders do to learn and grow? Secondly, what actually goes on at the elders' meetings? And then the last thing regarding Wendell mentioned the savings account or the excess funds. So the first thing, what do the elders actually do to learn and grow? And so I've been sitting with the elders for about 3 or 4 years, and what seems to be the norm in the group meetings I've noticed over the time related to this is throughout the year there's a handful of books that we read through, articles, usually oftentimes related to the sermons and the sermon topics. Sometimes just areas that get brought up by members. So members might have a question or suggest a book, and one or most or all of us will read through that, discuss it, or we might just come up with novel information that we think people need to discuss or read through. Over the last couple of years, we've studied through books, articles together related to the Old Testament, providence, women in ministry, other things. Personally, I have a pretty regimented approach that I go through, probably largely related to the fact that my brain is just a bunch of mush and I need very much structure in my life. And so I create structure so that I actually continue to learn. I'm sure Dave and Wendell have some sort of plan that they have. I'm sure you all emulate something like that in your own lives in some way. But for me personally, I read through the scriptures cover to cover two or three times a year in the morning usually. And then later in the day, I actually do actual study. So read, study. I read through maybe 7 or 8 books or articles throughout the year in a book club that I'm involved with here at the church. I'll oftentimes do follow-up research related to issues that come up in sermons or Josh's lessons in youth group or specific book club topics. Obviously do research related to sermons and Brink lessons that I do. And I'll grab books of interest just systematically that just come to me. Recently, I've been reading through a book by Carson on prayer and a book on covenant and dispensational theology that Josh gave to me, that Wendell gave to him. And I also make time throughout each day to pray, albeit that's usually in my car or as I lay in bed at night, but that's an area I'm actually, with this book I'm reading on Carson, trying to improve, hone in, and get better at. As far as what do the elders actually do in the meetings? Now, Wendell just recently started posting the minutes out back on the bulletin board so you can get a general idea of what actually happens. This is all before Nate comes over. Because Nate always comes over towards the end, not for the actual meeting. A typical meeting will begin with prayer, oftentimes a meal. Much of what's discussed and hashed out relates to upcoming sermons and kind of the minutiae involved in prepping, who's going to be involved, what materials are going to be involved, what things do we need to get the people participating in. There will be time spent reviewing materials or books, again, like we talked about, like we did with the Old Testament, Providence, Women in Ministry, and then specific issues or complaints or member concerns or things that just need to be dealt with, you know, with the goal of coming up with remedies and answers. And now there was a concern. I've talked to a couple of people, and I think on the affirmation forms there was some concern that we deal with more too many functional matters, like finances or building maintenance concerns, and those, you know, those more practical items. And so they are discussed, and, you know, with the goal of being, you know, the issue that they take up a pretty small part. Wendell's made pretty deliberate efforts over the last couple of years in particular, to kind of farm out a lot of those jobs. I mean, but the fact in the end, I mean, those are things that need to get done, and they need to get done well, and still kind of part of our job. So it will take some direct involvement. But again, the goal is that it's actually going to, most of that will get farmed out. And the last thing relates to the savings account or excess funds. So we have a pretty generous church, as Wendell was talking. You know, the elders take seriously the charge that we have to manage our funds appropriately with frugality and wisdom, as we pray about nearly each week. Some have shared concerns regarding extra or excess funds that we have in savings. And it's true that we have excess funds earning about 4% right now. But the fact is, if giving ceased today, we would have less than a year worth of operating funds with that money in the bank. So regular giving is still necessary to, you know, continue the day-to-day. In fact, our giving is one of the ways that we demonstrate, as Wendell often says, this every member ministry. At some level, the phrase excess funds could be interpreted many ways to many people. It's not like extra money is just sitting there being hoarded. As mentioned before, it's, you know, if giving ceased, we'd still need to pay our bills. Also, these extra funds could come in handy if members hit hard times or if emergencies come to the church. And if we outgrow the facility, you know, down the road and we want to move on, we don't want to burden future generations with more financing that's necessary. These additional funds could come in handy. And, you know, I should mention, we give like 17% of our money away to Reasonable Hope. I know other places that we're very intimately involved with, Tom and Suja in Africa, Shevet Akim in Israel, Created Equal amongst, you know, the beans. And we've talked about bumping that to about 20% in the future. So all this to say is that maybe this excess term might be better labeled supplemental or emergency or just additional funds. But any questions? Should I take questions? There's no need for questions. There's probably no questions. Dave.
I'm sure there are questions. I don't buy that at all. I can direct them to Tim. We can pause on that. People say questions and then they leave the, you know, stage 10 seconds later. Did you get all my slides, Steve? That was a joke. I don't have any slides. Pull a Josh. I have no slides. What? Right. That's great. So I thought I was going to have all kinds of cleanup work to do after you two. That's great. Everything was right on. Just to be clear, we do actually have a philosophy of ministry stated on the church's website. If you click on, like, on the homepage, you get to know us more. I don't remember exactly what the word is. But there's about a 3-page. Man, I'm like Wendell now. I didn't bring my water. Is this your water?
I didn't drink it.
Excuse me. There is a 3-page or so, something like that, philosophy of ministry that does sum up local church, the community, and the world, tier 1, tier 2, tier 3. So that is actually spelled out. But like he said, we don't want it to be a slogan because it's hard to be consistent with that or really spell out what you're trying to say. So that is a thing definitely worth reviewing in case you didn't know it was there. If I had to put it into a line, which is may or may not be helpful, I would say, our first desire is, of course, to be a faithful body, that is, being faithful to Scripture. The deposit of Scripture is what the elders are supposed to guard. That's something we talk about a lot in meetings, for the specific purpose of building up individual believers in the church, because that's what makes up the church, it turns out, so that they can go and proclaim Christ's death until he returns. And that would be about as simple as I could put it. And of course, that what that means when you go out could play out a lot of different ways, obviously depending on our gifts and abilities and who we are. Two things I want to mention specifically before I talk a little bit about sort of my own ideas on philosophy of ministry and buy-in to it, which I think is really, really important. So home groups are starting up again. Just to give you a couple more specifics, these are a little bit different on many levels from what we've done before. As Wendell said, the idea is for them to be sort of ongoing and perpetual. Therefore, we're cutting down the meeting times to once a month to make that sustainable. What usually happens when we have this happened a lot with E4, happened a lot with home groups. People get excited. They show up 2 or 3 times, and they just can't pull off 6 to 8 weeks. I don't know what happens, but it happens a lot. It's actually kind of frustrating. But it seems like, well, maybe there's a better way to do this. And we're also sort of had the idea and a lot of feedback from people saying that social concerns, and maybe COVID plays into this somewhat, I don't know, but social concerns were becoming more elevated and trying to get away from the idea that we feel like we have to be teaching intense doctrine every time we get together because it's a church function. It's like, well, there's nothing that says we have to do that, right? So the idea is then it is less heavy on content, more interested in time together, prayer, building relationships, and then again, like I said, making it ongoing. As we said, we apparently are doing one on Tuesday coming up here, which is great timing. But that'll be fun because it'll just be kind of an intro to see who shows up. I am planning on, was this the book you were talking about? Okay, yeah, I was thinking I might go through this book in the home group. Not necessarily that you would have to buy the book, and I'm not even going to tell you what it is yet because I may change my mind later. But something where we might want to have some foundational material to talk about sometime. We had the idea when meeting at the Hubbards before of just talking through one of the Psalms briefly, but then also focusing on the culture and what's going on and what do we think about that. It's just, we had some great conversations. Apparently we've separated from their home group, big rivals now, so we're gonna we have an open bar, so we're gonna find ways to draw people away from your group. I don't know, that's what my wife said. So Wendell's, you're having one, that'll be the cool group, not till June. Oh boy, I'm so sorry.
The first one, we haven't decided when the first one.
Okay.
We have a conflict that.
Okay, but you're planning on having a home group.
Yeah.
That's all I was saying.
Everyone.
Okay. All right. That'll be the pool / cool group. Yeah. I wanted to update you a little bit on Josh's studies. He has just finished up. You have your last paper coming due in a week, and then he's off for the summer, has a house to work on, but he's maintaining a 4.0, which is great. Yeah. That is out of 12, so anyway, no, it's not. Courses taken, Intro to Old Testament, Theology 101, which is, of course, very foundational stuff. Just wrote a couple papers, Influence of Canaanite Religion on the Israelite Worship of Yahweh. So he is now extremely skeptical of everything. That's great. We were talking about God's impassibility last night, which is basically, is God subject to involuntary passions? And I was like, wow, that is something I haven't studied, and I am very interested. And you're going to teach on that sometime, I hope. Excellent. Great. So he's doing a great job and reports to us, and there's a lot of accountability there. It turns out we may not need to hold him accountable, but he's doing a great job. So in closing, I just wanted to mention a couple things about what I think people get out of church. I know I get like emotional for no reason. Anyway, but that happens. I don't know. To make a joke that it happened when I had cinnamon toast this morning. It made me, I didn't cry. I'm just trying to, all right, here we go. So I have always appreciated coming to our church, probably just set against the background of my own church, because just a lot of things I wasn't taught. I wasn't able to think through things very well. I didn't have reasons for my faith, and so I think, you know, anybody who stumbles across that for the first time, it's like, it's profound. And then when we address these things, we don't do them, sort of the nature of it is we don't do it with gimmicks and short statements. It's a lot of hard work, but we benefit from the hard work of many people that have taught here, obviously. We address error often. There's a ton of benefits to that. There are some concerns that it can, when we correct error, can come across harsh. That is something I think we continue to work on here, to not project a ignorant, what's the word I'm looking for? Arrogant, thank you. Arrogant attitude towards other churches or the world around us, and of course, just always those kind of things we have to be careful of. Certainly, and then a huge one is benefiting from deeper relationships where I think a lot of people end up having, you know, they go to church and then their real friends are elsewhere, and I know for a lot of us that is not the case. We have friends elsewhere, but we have a lot of friends here, and it should be a natural thing to be friends with other Christians. So we have in-house relationships. We've started up men's meetings some years back, hoping that other men will get in small, ongoing accountability groups with others, because you can't, there's only so much you can do by meeting twice a year. Hopefully that's obvious. And all these things, just cultivating a like-mindedness with other people. I think a lot of us know that goes a long way, and that's a hard thing to pull off. It's like, that's why I often use the term buy-in. It's like, if you buy into the philosophy of the church and you say, largely, this is a great thing, we have things to work on, we always have things to work on. When you buy into that, then this is a great thing. If you're always skeptical of it and not quite buy into it, as we see happen often when people leave the church, some of the statements that people make made me wonder, like, you know, like, why did you stay here this long if you don't understand anything we're doing? Or, you know, not in a, I'm mad at you, but we want people to be engaged, like Wendell said earlier, in their church body and being productive. And if you can't find a way to do that here, you should please find a way to do it somewhere. Although, of course, we do feel like we have a lot to offer. Boy, I got a bunch of stuff I got to skip here. So the effect ended up being for me just, Nate and I talk about this a lot. Basically, I guess the way I would put it is feeling an obligation to our body. I suppose that has a negative tone to it sometimes. I certainly don't mean it that way. I mean obligation in a good way. Like Wendell said, if you think about it as courting instead of dating, there's an intentionality and a seriousness to it. And after feeling an obligation, a desire to contribute, perhaps rather than complain about things. Being well-balanced, trying to apply what we do well and the things we don't do well, trying to grow into that. I've also recently, especially with Wendell talking on Ephesians, it just kind of really struck me within the last year how much me and Jesus and that idea, how corrosive that is in our culture, that, you know, even from the time of Genesis looking towards Revelation, really viewing it as not so much God came to die to save me, which is true. The more profound truth is that he came to restore his church, and then that we all get to live together forever, and that's so much better, like, you know. So the individualism, I think that's very unhealthy, but it just is pervasive in our culture. So I would just encourage you to be thinking through, what am I doing to deliberately contribute? Am I on the same page with, if you haven't had a chance to read The Philosophy of Ministry, go do that and try to understand that better and be decided in your efforts to move forward in one way or the other. Identifying ways in which you're contributing to the church. Do you even care to do that? The idea of consumerism, of course, is the other, perhaps even worse problem in our culture, that it's, I go to church to either be entertained or what can I get out of it? And then once a certain need is met, I move on to the next church. And my first reaction, again, is usually anger and like frustration, but then it's just more sadness because it just means that they're just a strange way to live as a Christian. And I think it is indeed very sad. So I just know that I've gained a lot from buying in with the good and the bad, both. Two thoughts to leave you with. The one is, again, so what typifies you? Would you probably fit better if I had to, if it's a false dichotomy, but if I, you like that, Josh? Okay, yeah. Would you be better described as a complainer or a supporter? You know, do you find ways to be critical, or are you better at building up the body? I would read Hebrews 13:17, but it would sound oddly self-serving about making the elders' work a joy. But it is true. I can just direct it at Wendell, okay? Does Wendell get more criticism or support from you? I think that's a fair question. The second point is, what typifies you? Are you more of a giver or a taker? And those are similar, but really not at all the same idea. Giver or taker, that comes up in regular human dynamics, and I think people forget that church here is just, it's another group of people. And granted, we're Christians, and so more of is expected of us in certain ways. But again, if you're perpetually a taker, that's going to limit how much really people want to even spend time with you, right? If you're a giver, that generally is the best way to build up your own faith and become a stronger person. Perhaps ironically, right? But that is true. I use the analogy sometimes. I think I got it from my friend Todd, about it's like cashing in equity. You build equity in a relationship, and then when you have a need, that's the time that you cash it in, and then people are so much more willing to be there to support you because that's how you've built empathy with them. And I think people just think the church is different, but it is different in a way because we do have higher expectations, but at the end of the day, we're just people. And so, like, if you think of the passage in Romans 12, rejoice with those who rejoice, mourn with those who mourn, that is a great idea, but that is a hard thing to do with people that you haven't hardly gotten to know. Like, maybe better people than me can do that, but that's the goal, and there are very then practical ways we can all find to work that out. So I would definitely encourage you to rethink those things. Look at your relationships in the church. Are they where you would like them to be? All right. do you have any questions? And I actually mean that. I could just stand here like we do when we share with music until you guys get uncomfortable. I'm not going to actually do that because maybe you don't have questions. So I'm going to close with two things. One, remind you that you will be subject to teaching from Romans the next 2 weeks. Sorry. But we're going to be going through Romans 6, a couple of verses from 7 even, so that's a little ambitious. So I'll change the sort of depth of the material we'll go through, you might say. So I consider this an assignment. I'm not even going to say I would like you to read through Romans 7. You should read through Romans 7 because you can all read, right? So you can do that. It's not that hard. You have audiobooks. There's so many ways to do this. So not just chapter 6, but again, the point I keep making about Romans is all the context that leads up to where we're at is really important. Chapter 6 and a little bit of chapter 7, yes. Sure. Well, read through chapter 7.
Read through
chapter 7. When you read, of course you're reading through it. That would be redundant. All right. Thank you. Chapters 1 through 7.
There we go.
Oh, gosh. Wow. Okay. Yes, and it's in the bulletin. Right. All right. Well, please stand. I'm going to leave you with Paul's remarks from 1 Thessalonians 5. And I think it's interesting because, of course, he's addressing the Thessalonians, so we could think of this as hopefully the things that Paul said to them could be, in theory, true of us, starting at verse 10. He died for us so that, whether we're awake or asleep, we may live together with him. Therefore, encourage one another and build each other up, just as, in fact, you are doing. Now we ask you, brothers and sisters, to acknowledge those who work hard among you, who care for you in the Lord, and who admonish you. Hold them in the highest regard, in love because of their work. Live in peace with each other. And we urge you, brothers and sisters, warn those who are idle and disruptive. Encourage the disheartened. Help the weak. Be patient with everyone. Make sure that nobody pays back wrong for wrong, but always strive to do what is good for each other and for everyone else. Rejoice always. Pray continually, give thanks in all circumstances, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. You may go in peace.